The nation's looking forward to the July 4th holiday, and you might be looking forward to spending some of it in your local movie theater. And while nobody should go to the movies for an accurate view of American life, our film contributor says the entertainment industry does a particularly terrible job depicting other countries and cultures. Sean Edwards is a movie critic for Fox Television in Kansas City, and he's our frequent guest to talk about the movies. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
Now, you obviously have been thinking about this for a while. How do you think American films misrepresent other cultures? And you really think it's that egregious, really different from the way they, you know, misrepresent or fantasize about things in American life?
You know, I think so. And even from the American perspective, a lot of historical accuracies in the movies are sort of skewed to one particular perspective.
Well, give us some examples where you think movies in the U.S. get it wrong, particularly about foreign cultures.
I guess the biggest example I could use would be the latest Indiana Jones movie, Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, because a lot of that movie takes place in South America. And one of the things that the movies always seem to do is they make outside cultures seem so foreign and seem so unbelievable, as if the people who are part of that culture couldn't have possibly created great works of art or mastered engineering or developed, you know, architecture. There's always some outside force that had to help them do it.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you're saying it's always got to be some extraterrestrial, you know, beyond Earth force at work here, rather than saying that, you know, we didn't have extraterrestrials didn't write the American Constitution. So why is it so unlikely?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Like the Mayans and the Aztecs weren't smart enough to build the pyramids. Aliens had to land on Earth. And the movies do this a lot.
I want to play a short clip from a film that's gotten some criticism that's just recently released this summer that some people have pointed out as being an example of how Hollywood just takes it just too far when it comes to foreign cultures. This is from The Love Guru, starring Mike Myers. Here it is.
Guru Hathas Malvina was a very chaste man. In order to set himself free of worldly distraction, he had taken an oath of celibacy. Not too long ago, the Guru Hathas Malvina died of a disease that strangely had all the hallmarks of syphilis.
Now that's Mike Myers in The Love Guru. As I said, he's starring as kind of a second-rate faith leader patterned apparently on Indian spiritual leaders. Now some people have said that they just think this is particularly offensive to the culture of India and to Hindus in particular. But other people say, look, it's a stupid comedy. Why should we take it seriously when it doesn't take itself that seriously?
I think the people who say, why are you taking this so seriously, have been brainwashed to the point where they don't see why this is wrong. And this has been done so much that people just sort of overlook it. It's okay to make fun, but until you see the balance where you see movies that respect this culture, you know, you can't just keep poking fun at other cultures and just totally dismissing it as a one-liner or off-putting joke.
And there's another movie that is also controversial for that reason. It was Borat, which offended people from Kazakhstan. And so let me just play a short clip of this. This is Sacha Cohen. He's starring as Borat. In this clip, he's meeting up with some African-Americans during a tour of the U.S. And I do feel that I need to warn you that some of this language is offensive.
Can you teach me a speaker like you?
What are you trying to say?
How you say, how do you do?
What's up with it?
What's that with it?
Yeah.
What's up with it, Vanilla Face? Me and my homie Azamat just parked our slab outside. Please. We're looking for somewhere to post up our black asses for the night. So bang bang, skid skid. We're just a couple of pimps, no hoes.
So there you have it. Again, something to offend just about everybody. Sean?
Yeah, this, and you know what? This seems to be the trend now in movies where, you know, you take a culture and everybody says we're too PC, so they try to go the opposite direction by showing that, hey, you know, if we make more fun, then we're actually being more PC. But I don't think this type of humor works because you don't have the balanced perspective.
Given that Americans come from all over the world, why do you think this persists?
Well, because although you do have Americans who come from all over the world, you don't have Americans from all over the world in the film industry. You know, until you have Americans from all over the world who are screenwriters and directors and producers and working at studios, you won't see that balance on film.
What about the whole question of films that seem to sort of present an alternate reality, films that have predominantly black casts? And there are also some films increasingly that come out with predominantly Latino casts. And I'm sure in the future that there are films that will have predominantly sort of Asian, South Asian casts, because they'll be produced, they'll be independently and produced. Do you think that those help the situation, or do they just sort of present, you know, their own sort of false realities?
No, I totally think they help if they're done in the right way. Like I said, it's all about, you know, the key word in this situation is balance. For every film that's loaded with buffoonery, you want to see a film that's loaded with positive images. So there's nothing wrong with an all-Latino cast and a Latino movie. There's nothing wrong with an all-African-American cast and an African-American movie. But it's about how the images are presented, because the images are very powerful. You know, if you get the positive on one hand, you can tolerate the negative a little bit better. But because you rarely see the positive when it comes to other cultures, it's just the other is just so unbearable because there isn't that balance that exists.
Tell me again, though, why you think this matters. Obviously, film matters deeply to you. This is your life. But for people who say, look, I just go to the movies every couple of weeks just to take my mind off my troubles and, you know, my mortgage and everything.
Right, exactly.
You know, what do you say to people who say, oh, you know, Sean, lighten up?
No, I'm a very lighthearted guy, but I do understand that images are very powerful, especially when these films are shown abroad, overseas in foreign countries, because to a lot of people, their only knowledge and their only interaction with certain cultures are through the movies. You know, they only think that certain cultures act a certain way because they see movies, which is for a long time why African-Americans were always thought of as only, like, you know, prostitutes and criminals, because that's all you would see.
So let's not just be haters. Are there any films particularly out now or easily acquired that you think show respect for other cultures, a realistic picture of other colors that you recommend?
Yeah, actually, there's one movie in particular that is outstanding that does a great job of doing that. And it's a small movie that stars Richard Jenkins called The Visitor, which is, it's just an excellent movie. It's one of the movies that sort of presents the counterpoint to all the dumb jokes and the bashing of cultures that you see on the big screen.
And Sean, just give me, you know, the 10-second version of the plot of The Visitor.
Yeah, The Visitor deals with the guy who has a chance encounter with an immigrant couple who happens to change his perspectives and views on their culture. And if we had more movies like The Visitor, then movies like The Love Guru and 10,000 BC and Don't Mess with the Zohan would be a little more tolerable.
Sean Edwards is a critic for Fox in Kansas City, Missouri. He joined us from NPR West. Thanks again, Sean.
Hey, thank you very much.
Who comes out on top if you take an Oscar-winning veteran actor and match him with a teen TV star who made his name on Nickelodeon? Our critic Bob Mondello says the answer surprised him in the new film, The Whackness.
The year is 1994, and high school senior Luke Shapiro is in a sort of a defensive funk as he introduces himself to the camera, lonely, though he won't admit it, and fatalistic in the way of teenagers everywhere.
I don't need high school friends. One week they're listening to Criss Cross, the next they're listening to Pearl Jam. I'm not like that. I'm loyal. I mean, I still listen to cassettes. But tomorrow, my life changes. Tomorrow, I graduate. And then I go to my safety school. And then I get older. And then I die.
It's a life plan of sorts. As played by Josh Peck, Luke's a pretty together kid whose biggest complaint is really that girls barely notice him unless they're looking to buy marijuana. He's a dope dealer, hoping to put himself through college with the profits. He has thousands saved up already. And one of his best customers is his analyst, played by Ben Kingsley, who trades him therapy sessions for weed. That's right, the doctor's receiving the drugs, not prescribing them, and sometimes smoking them during the sessions. Hard to say who's getting better value from that deal.
Are you popular in high school, Dr. Squires?
Well, I wouldn't say popular. No, I
played baseball. I was a debater.
Did you ever want to kill yourself?
Not till much later.
Then you must have been popular. I'm not.
This has got nothing to do with being popular, Luke. You're just not trying hard enough. You must think about it. The different scenarios. Random sex in phone booths. Chance encounters in discos, the way they smell, the things they say, even when they're saying nothing at all.
As you may be gathering, Dr. Squires has some issues of his own. And if he knew that his stepdaughter was the girl of Luke's dreams, his advice might be a little different. Kingsley plays the doctor as a man in such midlife crisis overdrive that you'd think he would run away with the whackness. But Josh Peck, who began his acting career comparatively recently as a pudgy sitcom star on Nickelodeon, more than holds his own, slimmed down since TV, and oddly confident in Luke's insecurity, he dominates the proceedings with dweeby, open-mouthed charm, helped no doubt by the fact that this is a semi-autobiographical story from writer-director Jonathan Levine. The filmmaker has blessed his coming-of-age tale with a catchy hip-hop soundtrack, characters who feel grounded no matter how odd their circumstances, and a girl worthy of Luke's dreams, Olivia Thirlby, as the alluring stepdaughter.
So how come we, like, never hung out in school?
Because I was a loser? I mean, not like a loser, you know, but I was definitely the most popular, the unpopular.
Or maybe the most unpopular of the popular.
Hey, either way, you're mad out of my league.
So what, I'm slumming now?
Perhaps. You want a beer?
Yeah.
The whackness may alarm parents who would prefer that their kids' favorite Nickelodeon stars not leap right into selling drugs and losing their virginity when they hit the big screen, but the story's not really about youthful indiscretions anyway. More a tale of a young man struggling towards maturity, even as an older man struggles to abandon it. With that story and that offbeat friendship central, the whackness will likely strike plenty of chords with plenty of audiences. I'm Bob Mondello.
Some science courses are created for non-scientists. You've probably heard of classes referred to as Rocks for Jocks or Physics for Poets. Well, this summer, San Jose State University is offering a new class. It's called Physics for Cartoonists. It's paid for by a $200,000 grant from the National Science Foundation. Lonnie Shabelson reports on how animation students are learning the physics of falling, punching, and running into walls.
What is it that makes Looney Tunes loony?
Meep, meep.
When Roadrunner lures Wile E. Coyote at seemingly supersonic speed off the edge of a cliff,
meep.
What makes it funny is that the coyote freezes in midair, looks down, and realizes there's no cliff under him anymore. Then, he rockets straight down into the ground. But according to the rules of physics, Wile E. Coyote can't freeze in midair before falling, or fall straight down. When a real coyote speeds off a cliff, he falls immediately, and in an arc. Even though Roadrunner often breaks the laws of physics, it's the favorite cartoon of physicist Alejandro Garcia. He's teaching this class the physics of animation for cartooning students.
It's the first time we're doing one of these classes.
He tells them about Newton's law of inertia, which means that with a similar applied force, big things move more slowly than smaller things. But for this class, Garcia illustrates Newton's law with a cartoon dog.
The little dog is going to go, and then the big dog's going, dum, 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 dum.
If a cartoonist follows the law of inertia in her drawings, a giant's legs must move slower than the legs of a fast-running little boy, which leads to a cartooning dilemma.
Well, if the giants have this slower motion, are you able to outrun a giant? And the answer is no. Because if the giant is 25 times your height, then each step that the giant takes 5 times longer. It is slower, indeed, in terms of the amount of time per step, but those steps are real long.
But why teach physics to cartoonists? The whole point of cartoons is to leave reality behind. Animals talk.
Just to keep those lame-brained humans from trying to stop us.
And sing.
Watch out, 'cause here we come.
Superheroes survive lightning strikes. And pandas do kung fu. Why should a talking, flying pig obey the laws of physics?
You have to know what the rules are in order to break them to advance the story successfully and keep the audience believing in what they're seeing on screen.
Illustrator Courtney Graner co-directs the animation program at San Jose State. He points out that if a tiny bird punches an enormous reptilian monster and the monster is knocked off his feet, it means that's one strong superbird. If he's just any old bird in the story, the animator should stick to the laws of physics, and the monster wouldn't budge.
Our feet are grounded on the planet because of gravity. This is our reality.
Physicist Garcia agrees that cartoons must have an anchor in reality. That's why cartoonists should learn physics. But in the end, he says, what works is what makes the story better.
We never have told these students, oh, no, no, that animation's wrong. This should be moving in this fashion.
The physicist says that when a cartoonist makes a deliberate, thoughtful choice to turn the rules of physics on and off to make the perfect story.
Well, that's just genius.
For NPR News, I'm Lonnie Shavelson.
We asked a favor of Professor Garcia to evaluate the physics in the new film, The Incredible Hulk. You can watch a video of his assessment at npr.org.
And in Hollywood, Will Smith is just about as close as you can get to a sure thing. His movies consistently open to strong ticket sales. This long holiday weekend, he has a superhero flick, Hancock. Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan says this new star vehicle is a challenge even for Will Smith.
Where is it written that superheroes have to be selfless? What would happen if an individual with supernatural powers were surly, self-absorbed, and acid-tongued? Hancock asks those smart questions but ends up with dumb and dumber answers. Hancock has all of Superman's talents, but he's often drunk and/or hungover when the call to action comes, so he causes as much trouble as he prevents. This is the guy the words collateral damage were invented for. Things might have gone on like this forever for Hancock. After all, who knows how long a superhero's liver can hold out? If he hadn't one day saved the life of a public relations man who wants to change his image. Soon our hero is acting like the soul of politeness.
Good job! Do I have permission to touch your body?
Yes!
It's not sexual! Not that you're not an attractive woman. You're actually a very attractive woman. And
get me the hell out of here!
But then, just about without warning, Hancock takes a completely unexpected and head-shaking plot turn that derails the film in a way that it never recovers from. The creators of Hancock truly had a tiger by the tail with their primary idea. But once they let go, the beast turned around and swallowed them whole. It's a strange feeling to see the summer's most promising premise self-destruct into something bizarre and unsatisfying, but that is the Hancock experience. It has to be emphasized that though the film's trailers carefully hide it, Hancock has a blisteringly profane tongue. How diatribes that would make a stevedore blush got a PG-13 rating is a question for another day.
Three years after he shot and killed himself, too many people remember Hunter S. Thompson as a caricature for the drugs and the alcohol, the guns, the explosive rants. But one of the iconic characters of the 60s and 70s was also one of the best and most original journalists of the 20th century. No one who ever read it will ever forget the passage from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, where Thompson describes the moment in the late 60s when the young and idealistic believed that they were unstoppable, that their energy alone would triumph over old and evil.
We had all the momentum. We were riding the crest of a high and beautiful wave.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
So now, less than 5 years later, you can go up on a steep hill in Las Vegas and look west, and with the right kind of eyes, you can almost see the high water mark, that place where the wave finally broke and rolled back.
Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight.
Actor Johnny Depp reading the words of Hunter S. Thompson in a new documentary by filmmaker Alex Gibney. Alex Gibney joins us from our bureau in New York. His new film is Gonzo, the life and work of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson. And thanks very much for coming in today.
Good to be here, Neil.
How did you decide to make a film about Hunter Thompson?
It seemed to me that it might be interesting to make a film about a guy who broke all the journalistic rules at a time when people in power were using these you know, ad hoc rules against journalists, and sometimes bending the rules in unconscionable ways, like the way the White House somehow managed to credential a part-time male prostitute named Jeff Gannon so that he could ask softball questions from the back of the room whenever, you know, the president of this or the press secretary got into trouble. So in times like that, it seems to me you need somebody who's going to break the rules or at least think about how somebody did it way back when.
Well, Hunter Thompson might have approved of Jeff Gannon.
He might have.
He might have. But
he would have been there to shout him down at the same time, I think.
And as you say, he broke all the rules. I mean, there was a kind of movement, if you will. You don't really talk about the idea of new journalism in your film, but you do have some of the people most closely associated with it, Tom Wolfe and Tim Krause, who was, of course, a colleague of Hunter Thompson's at Rolling Stone.
That's right. And there were others, too, who weren't quite as out there, people like David Halberstam, people who, you know, said it wasn't enough to report. You could begin to infuse your reporting with your own perception so that and what's wrong with that after all? I mean, you give some people a sense of the world outside, but don't deprive them of how you might see or how you might analyze the situation.
And his first great success, Hunter Thompson's, was with Hell's Angels, where he spent a year with Hell's Angels and wrote a book. It's not quite the gonzo that he later got into, but it is definitely different from the journalism that was going on in that day.
That's right. It's proto-gonzo. You can begin to see hints of it. But one of the most important things was that he, as Tom Wolfe said, was embedded in the Hell's Angels battalion. I mean, this was a time when many reporters were in pressed trench coats, you know, using their microphones or their steno pads and going up to people for comments on stories that seemed to be part of some mysterious grand narrative. But Hunter wanted to see the story from the inside out, so he hung out with the Angels. He rode with them, and ultimately they beat the hell out of him in a final sequence that marked the end of his book. And he ends the book actually with a quote from Joseph Conrad: "Exterminate all the brutes."
Well, he learned some things about the Angels that an outlaw band that in the end lived up to their reputation or down to their reputation.
That's right. I think that for a while the Angels were being romanticized. Now, the Angels always played by their own rules. They didn't make any bones about that. But they were being romanticized as these kind of cute cult figures that you could have over for dinner and they would liven up the party. And indeed, as we saw to some tragic effect, you know, they were brought on as bodyguards in the famous Altamont concert in 1969 when a concert ultimately ended rather tragically in violence as a Hell's Angel killed somebody trying to shoot at the stage. So, you know, this was a tough crowd.
As we consider Hunter Thompson, one of the things that it's a central moment in the movie, actually, he runs for sheriff in his, adopted hometown of Aspen in Colorado, and darn near wins the thing.
That's right. I think he set out to do it as a complete lark. I mean, you know, part of his platform was he was going to rip up town streets and sod them. He was going to call Aspen Fat City, and he was going to arrest any drug dealer that had the temerity to sell drugs for money. He was going to put them in stocks in the town square.
I love the line where he shaved his head for that campaign so he could call his opponent the long-haired opponent.
That's right. That's right. There's no question yet. He was a radical.
Let's see if we get a real caller on the line. This is Eric. Eric with us from Santa Clara in California.
Hi. I grew up worshiping Hunter S. Thompson when I was in college and learning how to write. And it seems as though he was completely on his own back then. But I'm wondering if shows like The Daily Show and Colbert Report, this sort of sarcastic approach where fiction is more truthful than truth, are the natural heirs of his gonzo journalism. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Eric, thanks for the call.
Yeah, I think that's fair comment. I think that's absolutely right. I think the Colbert, particularly Colbert, but also Jon Stewart, are kind of heirs to some of what Hunter was doing. And not only because of the kind of quasi-fictional component, which I think Hunter was into also, but really, you know, saying it straight rather than saying on the one hand, on the other hand, more or less using the facts to say, oh, by the way, this our president just lied to you last night. I mean, it's more direct. And but also with a great sense of humor. There was a sense of attack, a sense of anger, but always with a hilarious sense of humor.
Well, in a way, I was going to ask comedians. You think of Saturday Night Live when it first started, and a lot of people doing stand up at that time. They seemed to absorb a lot of the that same spirit that Hunter Thompson had.
Yeah, that gonzo sense where you could go anywhere and take the absurdity of politics and blow it up and not try to pretend that these are respectable people talking in respectable tones.
Let's get Abel on the line. Abel with us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I just had a question for the documentary person. This past semester, I took a class in Mexican-American literature. And we read a book by Oscar Zeta Costa called Autobiography of a Brown Buffalo. And at the beginning of the book, there's a note from Hunter S. Thompson about how influential he was towards Hunter's writing. And I was just wondering if Oscar Costa is mentioned in your documentary at all.
Oscar is definitely mentioned in the documentary. I think Oscar probably deserves a documentary of his own. But we... Yeah. We have a loving – there's a section I found which I just love in the film where in the bowels of Hunter's archive, we found an audio tape that actually represents one of the chapters in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And it's a tour de force by Oscar because it's the so-called taco stand scene from from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I thought it was a piece of inventive – literature, you know, where they go to a taco stand and they ask this woman, you know, they say, we're looking for the American dream. And she says, oh, I know where that is. It's turned left by the psychiatrist's office down on Main Street. And they do this riff for a long time. But when you listen to the tape, it's Oscar who's playing the game. Hunter's kind of along for the ride. And Oscar is kind of driving it on and having great fun with this woman and playing this sort of double entendre game. He's really a very witty but ultimately very politically pointed guy. He's great. Great and inventive character.
Well, I'm glad to hear he's mentioned in there. I think Hunter gets a whole lot of acknowledgement, but sometimes Oscar gets kind of lost in the mix. And that Autobiography of a Brown Buffalo was incredible.
Abel, thanks very much for the call. Alex Gibney, good luck with the film.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Alex Gibney joined us from our bureau in New York. His new film is Gonzo: The Life and Work of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.